My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the executive director here at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 nonprofit think tank dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. And to achieve our mission of advancing U.S.-Taiwan relations, we undertake a number of key programs, which includes a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, which is released every Wednesday, where we invite contributors, authors, experts, emerging scholars who are interested in Taiwan policy issues to contribute timely articles related to Taiwan. Our second event, our major program, is our public seminar series, which all of you are participating in today, wherein we try to raise the visibility of Taiwan in the broader policy discussions here in Washington. Our third major program is an annual symposium that we are in the midst of planning for later this year, where we'll bring in leading supporters of the stronger U.S.-Taiwan relationship so that we can establish a baseline on how to really move the ball forward as it relates to Taiwan. We're also very pleased to announce just fairly recently that we've launched a new program called the GTI Scholarship Fund, where we want to encourage young American researchers and postgrads to conduct field research in Taiwan so that their understanding about Taiwan is based upon their knowledge and experiences with the people and the land there, and that, you know, as they pursue a career either in policy or in academia, that is informed by those experiences that they have. And we think that is a way that we can make a lasting impact on how Taiwan is perceived here in Washington and hopefully and across the world. So before I begin today's event, I also want to acknowledge a few of our distinguished guests in the room. They include several of our co-founders, Mr. Chen and Mr. Lin, to also include our vice chair, Jennifer Hu, as well as a number of our advisors, including Mr. Tom Hughes, Dr. Chen, Dr. Tsai, and John Dashik over there as well. If I'm missing anybody, please raise your hand and let me know right now. We're very pleased to have this event here today. It's a very timely event. When policy folks in Washington, D.C. talk about Taiwan, it's often framed by the events on the island post-1949, after the nationalist government established itself on Taiwan. The case in point, just this morning, I and many others in this room attended a meeting at a prominent think tank discussing the U.S. One China policy. In that discussion, history on Taiwan sounded like it began in 1949 and nearly ended in 1979. Martial law, white terror, democracy, third Taiwan Strait crisis, all make up the historical period of that very limited and narrow history of Taiwan. That is, however, far from the whole picture. Yet this is the common perception because that was the narrative of the ruling political elites that governed Taiwan post-1949. As Arthur Waldron, who is also one of our GTI advisors, wrote in his piece today about the legacy of Chiang Kai-shek, that narrative had defined Taiwan internationally. However, with Taiwan's democratization, new narratives began to emerge, and a history beyond that which was brought upon the island by the Chinese Civil War began to have a say on what Taiwan means. As we are here from the presentations today, the island of Taiwan, or Formosa, has a long and diverse history, a history that is more comprehensively reflected in the democracy that exists on Taiwan today. You have the background description of what the event of today is going to be about, so I'll allow you to read from that event description about what Professor Jacobs had artfully laid out. But to really to cut that point short, though, really is that what is really needed here is a historical analysis that will enable us to better explain many of the current political phenomena in Taiwan, such as the rapidly increasing sense of Taiwan identity. And so, with that in mind, I'm very pleased to introduce two of our excellent speakers today to help elucidate this topic. Our key speaker is Professor Bruce Jacobs on my immediate left. Bruce Jacobs is Emeritus Professor of Asian Languages and Studies at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, where he began teaching in 1991. His research has focused on Taiwan, China, comparisons between Taiwan and Korea, as well as such issues as Australian relations with Asia and human rights. In the early 1990s, Professor Jacobs served as a member of the Australia-China Council. His recent books on Taiwan include Local Politics and Rural Taiwan Under Dictatorship and Democracy, Democratizing Taiwan, and a Kaohsiung Incident in Taiwan, and Memoirs of a Foreign Big Beard. He has also edited a four-volume critical reading on China-Taiwan relations. Professor Jacobs has also co-edited and contributed to Changing Taiwanese Identities. His current project is a history of Taiwan. We're very pleased, and thank you very much for being here, Bruce. And as discussed after Bruce's remarks, Garrett van der Weis, to his left, Garrett is a longtime observer of developments in Taiwan. In 1980, while doing graduate work at the University of Washington in Seattle, he and his Taiwan-born wife started the Taiwan Communique. I'm sure that no one's a stranger to that publication in this room, a publication chronicling Taiwan's transition to democracy. From 1982 through 2005, he served in various positions in the Dutch government, including a seven-year stint as diplomat in Washington, D.C., while doing the Taiwan publication on evenings and weekends. In 2005, he retired from the Dutch government and became full-time liaison for the Formosan Association for Public Affairs, FAPA, which focuses on enhancing relations with the U.S. Senate and the State Department. In 2016, he retired from that position. Since 2011, he has taught history of Taiwan at George Mason University. So without further ado, Professor Jacobs, take it away.
I'm going to stand up here for my main talk, and I'll sit down there when we have discussion. I'd like to say thank you to Russell and to the Global Taiwan Institute for having me here. It's great to be at a new place, and it's a new place which I think is making quite a mark here in Washington. And it's a pleasure to be here to be speaking. In Australia, we have a new habit, which I think is a really good one, and it's one I'm trying to push in Taiwan, and I don't think it would be inappropriate here as well. And what we do is when we begin a talk like I'm doing now or open a conference, we express respect for the original inhabitants of this land and their elders and their antecedents, their ancestors and the people today. And I think that's a good move. And I think the oppression of Native Americans in America has been quite strong. I'm reading a book right now about the movie The Searchers, written by Glenn Frankel. It's quite an interesting book, but I'll tell you there was a lot of massacring and it was quite unpleasant. Now, today what I want to do, Russell's talked to you, and I was trained originally as a political scientist, but I didn't really like political science, and I moved among a number of different disciplines, including doing basically field research in an anthropological sense for my PhD. I'm now sort of towards the end of my career, and I'm working on a history of Taiwan, so I've turned into a historian. So what I want to do today is bring together some of the things that I've discovered about the history of Taiwan and some of the analysis, but the reason for doing that is I want to raise the implications of understanding Taiwan's history for policy about Taiwan, both as created in Taiwan itself and here in Washington and other places. So in the world today, and as I say, here in Washington, Russell's talked about a particular talk at a think tank where many people appear to be repeatedly saying the same things. There's a widespread impression that Taiwan is somehow a part of China. And I want to argue that this widespread impression is wrong, and that in fact Taiwan's history is quite different from that which is often drawn. And in sort of the end of my talk, I then want to suggest new understandings of Taiwan history can provide alternative possibilities for Taiwan's future. Now, is that gone? Good. What I call Chinese colonial perspectives, and I'll explain that in a little while, have distorted the writing of Taiwan's history. So under the colonial dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek, the official China yearbook declared, and the quote's up there, in history and culture, Taiwan is an integral part of continental China. And similarly, the white paper that the Chinese prepared in 1993 wrote, and this was in italics, Taiwan has belonged to China since ancient times. And the 2000 follow-up stated, Taiwan is an inalienable part of China. These perspectives have dominated international understanding of the Taiwan problem and continue to do so today. And I think the reason for that is Chinese propaganda is quite unrelenting. And yet such perspectives are relatively recent. The late Alan Wachman, who many of you may have known, who taught at Tufts University, documented that both the Chinese Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, and the Chinese Communist Party only claimed Taiwan as Chinese territory in 1942. So that was very late in all of these things. In fact, the so-called history of Taiwan by both the Chinese Communists and the former Chinese Nationalists is nonsense. This is a very important point. When the Dutch came to Taiwan in 1624, there were no permanent Han Chinese communities in Taiwan. This word Han Chinese,
Bruce, it's one slide ahead.
All right. Thank you. It's kind of hard to see there.
Yeah.
Come back to me, okay? If I do that again. So when the Dutch came, there were no permanent Han Chinese communities. What I was going to say was this word Han Chinese is a problematic term, and we can talk about that a bit more later. But Taiwan came Chinese came temporarily to Taiwan for three purposes. Merchants came to trade with Taiwan's aborigines, fishermen came to fish and then they went home, and pirates came to hide and then they too went home. And the evidence for this is quite clear from Dutch documents dating from the time. And Spanish documents also show that there were no Han Chinese living in northern areas which the Spanish controlled from 1626 around the areas of what's now Danshui and Jilong. Almost 50 years ago, one of the earliest Western scholars on Taiwan history, Lawrence G. Thompson, noted, quote, "The most striking fact about the historical knowledge of Formosa is the lack of it in Chinese records. It is truly astonishing that this very large island should have remained virtually beyond the ken of Chinese writers until late Ming times." And then he says explicitly he means the 17th century. And an early text from about 1350, that is during the Mongol period, may refer to Taiwan, but it mentions no Chinese living there and states, quote, "the foreign countries start with this one." In my research, I've sort of come to a generalization that I see Taiwan in three key historical periods. The first one we call the Austronesian period, or its Aboriginal history, which is up till the Dutch arrival in 1624. And I'm going to talk a bit about that today because there's some very interesting parts about that. Second period would be the colonial period from 1624 to 1988, which I'm going to talk about six colonial governments. And then I think the third period is from 1988 on, when Taiwan began the process of democratization. Taiwan separated physically from the Asian mainland during the Holocene period. So about 10,000 years ago, Taiwan physically separated away from Asia. Furthermore, and it's interesting, the Fujian area was the last place on the coast settled by Han Chinese. And this only occurred during the Sui and Tang dynasties, so from 589 to 906. So Han Chinese didn't even live in those areas until well in the modern era. Now, as part of my study of the history of Taiwan, I spent quite a bit of time reading young archaeologists who have studied Taiwan prior to the arrival of the Dutch in 1624. And today I want to just briefly summarize some of the more interesting results which are relevant to the present time. I've got an article that just came out in Taiwan Historical Research, which is a Taiwan journal at Academia Sinica, and I can send a copy to anybody that you're interested. It has much more about this pre-Dutch period. I don't know if you have a copy, don't you, Russell, too? Maybe you could get one from GTI as well. I think I'm going to run through this fairly quickly. There have been old Stone Age sites or Paleolithic sites dating about 25,000 BC. That's what BCE is before Common Era, or BC, and we used to say. But there's no evidence that these Paleolithic sites relate to later sites. However, there are Neolithic sites, or New Stone Age sites, which date back about 4,000 BCE, or about 6,000 years ago. And at this time, about 6,000 years ago, Taiwan had one general culture, the Dabengkeng, or TPK culture, which was distributed along Taiwan's coast, rivers, and lake shores. Now, in the years since then, Taiwan's coastal areas have been covered by thick and broad alluvial deposits, so many of the oldest archaeological sites, which were originally quite close to the coast, are now some distance away. And in addition, in eastern Taiwan, tectonic uplift has further removed these sites from the coast. Now, late TPK culture clearly had a maritime trading network connecting Taiwan and such islands as Penghu or Pescadores. For example, basalt adzes. You know what an adze is? You know, an axe is the blade is parallel to the handle. An adze is set this way. And they early were made with stone, and in Taiwan they were made with basalt. And we know which quarry they came from, the basalt came from in the Pescadores of the Penghu. And clearly, by the middle Neolithic period, say 2500 to 1500 BCE, or 4,500 years ago to 3,500 years ago, Taiwan had considerable agriculture. Its peoples had spread into the higher mountains in Taiwan, and cultures had become quite variegated, showing different strategies of adjusting to the environment. Now, the Middle Neolithic period, from about 2500 to 1500 BCE, is very interesting and important. I had heard that Taiwan was seen as the source of all the Austronesian peoples of the world. And as a person that's sort of interested in Taiwan, maybe a bit of a Taiwan patriot, I said, oh, that's just Taiwanism. But in fact, there are a lot of studies which have shown by linguists and by scientists, and in fact I found some really interesting articles in Science magazine, that in fact most people think that the Austronesian peoples of the world originated in Taiwan, and the migration started about 2500 BCE or 3500 years ago. Now, these people moved from Taiwan, they moved to every inhabitable island in the Pacific. In some of the islands, they made uninhabitable because they destroyed the environment. They moved eventually to New Zealand about 600 years ago. They inhabited coastal parts of Southeast Asia and went all the way across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar. And so Taiwan is sort of the origin of all these people. And it's quite a remarkable migration. And as I said, it's biological and linguistic evidence confirms the Taiwan origins. Now, unlike China and the countries of mainland Southeast Asia and Middle East and Europe, island regions such as Taiwan and the Philippines did not have a separate Bronze Age prior to the appearance of iron. Most of the archaeologists today are talking about Taiwan having a Metal Age, at which time both bronze technology and iron technology appeared, and this started about 400 BCE. Now, what happened there? Yep, that looks right, I think. Is that number 9?
Yep.
Okay, good. During the early Metal Age, say from about 400 BCE, modern archaeological research has demonstrated that Taiwan's peoples were involved in substantial trading networks that stretched at minimum as far as the South China Sea, including what is now the Philippines, eastern Malaysia, central and southern Vietnam, peninsular Thailand, and eastern Cambodia. And we've long known that in eastern Taiwan has a place which produces jade. Well, modern spectroscopy shows that the jade that has been found in all these places that's on the list came from Taiwan, came from the Hualien area. Furthermore, radiocarbon dating shows that these trading networks were active from about 500 BCE to 500 CE. Because different cultures wanted their jade ornaments carved in different ways, the factory that produced the jade in Hualien area began to produce blanks. So the blanks were sent out and people locally could carve them the way they wanted. But the jade itself came from eastern Taiwan. Now, in terms of these trading networks, we know that there are glass beads found in Taiwan, and these originated in modern India around 400 to 300 BCE, And later glass beads were also made now what is now Sri Lanka, Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Sumatra. So beads were, jade was going out, beads were coming in, and we also know that within Taiwan there was trade because glass beads have been found all over Taiwan, including glass beads in places that are high up like Alishan. So despite the fact that many of the indigenous peoples engaged in headhunting, there was also trade taking place. It would seem likely, considering that Taiwan was the origin of the peoples in the Pacific Island, it would seem likely that there was trade between Taiwan and the Pacific Islands. But there's been no archaeological evidence which demonstrates that yet. So that's likely, but we don't know for sure. And about this time when all this trading was taking place, the various cultures in Taiwan became more variegated, and there were at least 17 cultures, which approaches the number of cultures that we have today. Now, several aspects of the archaeological evidence demonstrate that Middle Age trading and technological contacts were with Southeast Asia and not with China. So, restate that. The evidence indicates that the trade was with Southeast Asia and not with China. For example, the casting molds for metal manufacture were made from southern Taiwan sandstone, but the styles were similar to those which had been found in Thailand and southern Vietnam. And these styles have never been seen in any Chinese sites. The chemical composition of the glass beads also show they came from Southeast Asia and not from China. And in addition, the beads tend to have distinctive bead spacers made of bone, which also come from Southeast Asia and not from China. So when the Dutch arrived, Taiwan was an island of Austronesians, the ancestors of today's Aborigines. And the Austronesians were divided. No one authority united Taiwan. Yet Austronesians did engage in trade with other people, including Japanese and Chinese traders. They also had trade with Southeast Asia. Austronesian products included deer skins and meat, as well as jade from the Hualien area. And I think it's just to give you a good example, Taiwan deer skins were an important part of the armor of Japanese samurai. So they made all sorts of things, including the socks that go into sort of thongs, the tabi socks, various aspects of the armor came from deer skins. Now it was the Dutch who first imported Han Chinese to Taiwan as labor and as agricultural workers. Some of the Chinese were employed as hunters, and they almost destroyed the ecology by killing too many deer. The Dutch believed the Chinese provided Taiwan with wealth, and one of the Dutch governors named Nicholas Verburg said, quote, "The Chinese are the only bees on Formosa that give honey." In fact, I think if you look at that article that I wrote, you'll see that when the Dutch came, the Aborigines had very prosperous lifestyles and were very healthy. The Chinese talked about the Dutch being a lot bigger than them, and the Dutch talked about the Aborigines being a head taller than them. So they were clearly healthy, they had good food, and so on and so forth. But according to an important scholar of the period, Tonio Andre, the Chinese made money because of the Dutch military and administrative structure. Now, as I suggested before, in looking at Taiwan's history, I've divided it into three big periods. And the second big period is the colonial period, from the arrival of the Dutch in 1624 until the death of Zhang Jingguo in 1988. So that's altogether 364 years. And during these 364 years, Taiwan underwent rule by a sequence of six regimes, all of which came from overseas. So there were the Dutch from 1624 to 1662, the Spanish who ruled northern Taiwan at the same time as the Dutch from 1626 to 1642, the Zheng family from 1662 to 1683, the Manchus from 1683 to 1895, the Japanese from 1895 to 1945, and the authoritarian Chinese nationalist under Chiang Kai-shek and Zhang Jingguo from 1945 to 1988. And as I said, this is the second of the three historical stages. Now, if we simply define a colonial regime as, quote, ruled by outsiders for the benefit of the outsiders, then clearly all of these regimes are colonial. I don't want to sort of get into a long discussion of academic discussion about colonialism, but I've used this definition, which I actually created, and I think it works. It certainly works in a Taiwan context, but I think it works around the world. So it's for a rule by outsiders for the benefit of the outsiders. And this perspective in a Taiwan context isn't new. Sherming, or Su Bang, who's now almost 100, made this very point in his Pathbreaking History of Taiwan, first published in Japanese in 1962, and later published in Chinese and abridged in English. And a new revision has just come out in Taiwan, and it's the first version published in Taiwan. And I think most people would agree that the Dutch, Spanish, and Japanese regimes were colonial. So let's look at the three regimes that people say, well, they weren't colonial, and I'll try to prove to you that they were colonial. So these are the Zheng regime, the Manchus, and the Chinese nationals under Chiang Kai-shek and Zhang Jingguo. I'm going to go through this reasonably quickly, but we can bring it, we can discuss it again if you want in question time. Zheng Tenggong was known as Kaxinga, and his father was known as Zheng Zilong, or some Nicholas E. Tran. They ran a major trading empire based in the southern Fujian area. And with the fall of the Ming Dynasty in 1644, Zheng Tenggong remained loyal, at least on the surface. And the Ming Dynasty ended in 1644, the emperor committed suicide, but a rump regime of imperial relatives continued the southern Song, and this continued until 1660, not the southern Song, the southern Ming, this continued until 1662. Which was the year that Zheng Tenggong succeeded in taking over Taiwan. Now, Zheng Tenggong did attack the Manchus, and he went as far north as Nanjing. And in Nanjing, he made some mistakes and was forced to retreat, and then he retreated quite quickly. But in 1659, he had attacked as far north as Nanjing. In his retreat, he ultimately felt he needed a stronger base than he could have in Fujian. And so he attacked Taiwan on May 1st, 1661. And many of his chief aides weren't enthusiastic. So this is from Lin Struve, who is the scholar of the Southern Ming Dynasty. She says, in the early spring of 1661, Zheng pressed his commanders to accept a proposal about which theretofore they had been unenthusiastic. That is, to remove the Zheng base to Taiwan. Again, few were happy about this, and one commander was punished for openly expressing what was on the others' minds, that Taiwan was a wild, inhospitable, disease-ridden place too far at sea. Zheng's mind was set, however, because he needed a territory that was large and more secure from the Qing, which still was located proximate to major East Asian maritime trade routes. As I said, Zheng Tenggong had basically lost control of his mainland territory in the area around Xiamen. But he continued to build a commercial empire that traded widely. And the Zheng Empire traded with Southeast Asia, it traded with Japan, it traded with Taiwan, it traded with Manila, which was the base, the head of the Spanish Empire. And in the words of the well-known Taiwan historian Huang Fusang, the Zheng family operated, quote, with the status of an independent nation and conducted foreign relations with Japan, Holland, Spain, England, and other countries. The Zheng regime also used Dutch colonial institutions, though they raised taxes. And incidentally, the Chinese nationalists in after 1945, from the beginning, used Japanese institutions, and they also raised taxes. The Zheng, however, remained separate from Aborigines. They didn't integrate. They basically came in as a conquering dynasty. They forced the Aborigines to provide food and other provisions. And the Zheng, at most, raised the number of Chinese in Taiwan from 30,000 to 50,000, from that range to 50 to 100,000. But the Aborigines in Taiwan were at least 100,000, so the Zheng remained a minority. Zheng Tenggong himself died within a couple of months of defeating the Dutch. And he was clearly insane. Tony Andre suggests that he may have had tertiary syphilis. It's not definite, but he may have. But another thing which I think is really important is Zheng Chenggong, even though he was of Chinese background, he was in no way representing any Chinese state. He was an independent merchant, and the activities that he was involved in, you could call him a merchant pirate or a pirate merchant, depending on how you want to emphasize this. And this wasn't unique to Asia either. Sir Walter Drake was a good pirate merchant who Queen Elizabeth really liked, and the Spanish King Philip II had quite a substantial price on his head. So I would argue that Zheng Chenggong, well, the Zheng family, because Zheng Chenggong was replaced by his son very soon after arriving, were a colonial regime. Now the next regime of the Manchus, the Zheng regime fell in 1683 when the Manchus conquered Taiwan as part of the suppression of the rebellion of the three feudatories, that's the San Fan Tu Luan, which was in southern China. And this rebellion and the conquering of Taiwan took place about 40 years after the Manchus conquered China. As I suggested, Zheng Chenggong's son, Zheng Jing, had intervened on the side which opposed the Manchus, and even though originally the Manchus didn't want to send a force to Taiwan, they felt they had to get rid of Zheng Jing, and so they did so. Now, in China, including under the Manchus, who were a foreign rule but took over some of the characteristics of the Chinese rulers, when they held court, they had secretaries around writing down what the emperors were saying. And these were later published in a book which was called the Shilu, to see if I've, or veritable records. I don't think I put Shilu up. But conquering emperor, who was the Kangxi emperor, declared that Taiwan had never belonged to either the Manchus or China. He said Taiwan is a small pellet of land, there is nothing to be gained by taking it, and no losses in not taking it. The Chinese is there if you're interested. And again, this comes from the Shilu, the veritable records. And his son, the Yongzheng emperor, said in 1723, from ancient times, Taiwan has not been part of China. My holy and invisible father brought it into territory. Now, most people who argue that Taiwan is Chinese, in fact, focus on the two centuries of Manchu control from 1683 to 1895. The Manchu Empire was administratively and ideologically very complex. Its rulers were all Manchus, as were many of its high officials. Manchus, for example, dominated the Grand Council, which is one of the key bodies in the government. Now, Han Chinese accounted for about 90% of the empire, so many high officials were naturally Chinese. But the ultimate sources of power rested with the Manchus, not with the Chinese. There's a quote I'm going to give you from, in fact, a man named Justin Tai, who happens to have been one of my PhD students, and it's an excellent quote about the nature of the Manchu Empire. He says, at the end of the 18th century, the Qing Empire encompassed an area twice the size of the Ming China. The court handled this expansion in a range of fashions without any one model of incorporation and administration. Differentiation and heterogeneity came to be the keys to the division of space within the empire. And as a conquest empire, a dynasty, Qing political culture and institutions derived as much from the traditions of Central Asia as they did from traditional Confucian theory. China, like Taiwan and many other places in East and Central Asia, had become part of the multinational Manchu Empire. So you could argue that China was a colony of the Manchu Empire. And Manchu rule in China differed from Manchu rule in Taiwan in at least a few respects, although, of course, until Taiwan became a separate province, it was administratively part of Fujian. There were some issues about when the Manchu governments had to deal with, say, the Japanese and the Americans, how much of Taiwan did the Manchus control. And there was a very interesting case in 1867 when an American ship ran aground off Pingdong in southern Taiwan, and the Aborigines killed most of the surviving crew. The American consul and shaman at the time was a man that, if you've done 19th century Chinese history, you'll have read about, General Charles William Legender. And he came across to Taiwan and he signed a treaty. Now, who did he sign the treaty with? I'll tell you to save time. He signed a treaty with the Aboriginal chief. He didn't sign it with the Manchu government. And I think that's significant. I'm going to move on a bit. That was 1867. There were more shipwrecks in dealing with the Japanese, but I'm going to skip that today so we can move on. But when in the negotiations that took place before the ceding of Taiwan to the Manchus, there were a lot of negotiations, and Li Hongzhang, who was the chief Manchu negotiator, implied he didn't want Taiwan because it was land beyond civilization. For those of you know Chinese, Huawaijidi. So they sort of thought Taiwan is not part of civilization. And so in summary, with the Manchu, there are two key points about Qing control of Taiwan. First, it was at best loose, minimal, and partial. And as I said, substantial parts of Taiwan remained outside of Qing control throughout the whole period of Qing rule. And secondly, this partial Qing control was not Chinese, but it was Manchu. And it's quite clear that if you look at what Chinese scholars said during the Manchu period, they hated the Manchus, who they saw as foreigners coming in and ruling them. And if you've learned anything about what Sun Yat-sen wrote in the early days, he also criticized the Manchus as foreigners. Now the third one I want to look at is the Chinese nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek and Jiang Zemin. And I'm arguing they too ran a colonial regime. I think if you compare the Japanese colonial regime with the Chinese nationalist regime from 45 to 88, you find the two regimes shared at least six characteristics in terms of their nature and in terms of the timing of their policies. Now, this sharing these characteristics doesn't demonstrate that the Chinese nationalist regime was colonial, but I think it strongly indicates it. And I'll just go through these very quickly. First of all, both regimes considered Taiwanese natives to be second-class citizens, and both systematically discriminated against Taiwanese. So this was clear political discrimination under the nationalists. Secondly, both regimes clamped down heavily at first. One Japanese source says that if the number that source says were killed by the Japanese, that would have been 1% of the population. And of course, under Chiang Kai-shek, February 28th, our bomb took place. And again, maybe as many as 30,000 people were killed. Third, both regimes continued high-level oppression for about 25 years. And this was the period under the national side of the White Terror. Fourth, owing to international and domestic circumstances, both colonial regimes liberalized, that is, they opened up the parameters for discussion and publication, at least to some extent. So towards the end of World War I, Woodrow Wilson gave his speech about self-determination, and in the other important Japanese colony, the Koreans, they had the major revolt called the March 1st Movement in 1919. And this liberalization under Taisho democracy enabled public discussion in Japan of various policies, and these led to at least some reform of the colonial regimes, including the appointment of civilian governors from October 1919 until September 1936. Similarly, under Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Ching-kuo, there was Taiwan's defeat in the UN, there was the Diaoyutai movement that former President Mao was involved in, there was the intellectual magazine, the Da Shui Zhaozhi, and there was promotion of Chiang Ching-kuo to the premiership in 1972, and he was liberalizing partly to consolidate his power. The fifth comparison is this: both regimes came under pressure. They again stepped up repression, and this Japanese created World War II, and then they continued pressure. They pushed in both Korea and Taiwan a Kuomintang movement, which was trying to make Koreans and Taiwanese into more assimilated Japanese. And of course, under the Kuomintang, repression occurred following the Kaohsiung incident of December 10th, 1979. And the sixth comparison is very interesting because both tried to make Taiwanese speak their national language. And the Chinese characters are the same in Japanese and in Chinese, but in Japanese it's Gokugo, and that means Japanese language, and in Guoyu, it's okay. So they were trying to make Taiwanese into second-class Japanese and Chinese. So what's sort of relevant is that under these colonial regimes, Taiwanization was impossible. And it was only with the development of democracy under President Lee Teng-hui that Taiwanization could survive and thrive. Now, what is Taiwanization? That's my translation for Bantuhua. I think if you translate Bantuhua as localization, then you've got to ask, what's the center? And I think Taiwanization is a better translation. And I think it's clear that under these colonial regimes, Taiwanese could not push Taiwan identity without incurring the wrath of the ruling regime. Let's start with what Taiwanization is not. Taiwanization is not democratization, though both processes in Taiwan have been closely linked. Taiwanization emphasizes identification with Taiwan, consciousness of Taiwan, and even a Taiwan nationalism. Under both the Japanese and Chinese nationalist colonial regimes, which treated Taiwanese as second-class citizens, appeals to Taiwan identity provided an important attraction to and source of strength for the opposition. But clearly all those that supported democracy didn't support a separate Taiwan, and this led to splits in the movement. In addition, being Taiwanese increasingly means, quote, I am not Chinese. Now, me as an Australian, I live in Melbourne, which is the capital of the state of Victoria, and I'm an Australian. I don't have any conflicts with that. And I think if you live in, say Silver Spring, Maryland, you can identify with Silver Spring, you can identify with Maryland, you can identify with being an American. But today, being Taiwanese now more and more means I am not Chinese, and I think that's a really important thing to say. And Taiwanese reject the idea that Taiwan culture is a subculture of Chinese culture. Rather, I think people would prefer to say something like Taiwan culture has many elements, including Austronesian, Aboriginal, Dutch, Spanish, Manchu, Japanese, Chinese, and Western. And because Taiwan's an island, there's lots more cultural interest. Now, what are some manifestations? From the early 1990s under President Lee Teng-hui to the present, Taiwanese included enjoyed Taiwanese food, such as hanji wine, the rice gruel with sweet potatoes. They become interested in Taiwan's history and society, literature, and culture. Wang Fuchang, in a book chapter, makes very clear how the number of publications about Taiwan just soared after the death of Zhang Jingguo. And politically, the use of Taiwanization has become very important in Taiwan politics from the early 1980s, and it's continued to the present. Now, this is a graph which I think should be familiar to many of you. There have been a whole number of surveys in Taiwan asking people, who are we? And they all show an increasing number of people who think we are Taiwanese, and a declining number of people that say we are Chinese. And these graphs are sponsored by, these surveys are sponsored by different peoples, and they have different absolute values. But the trends are the same. I like this one.
1 minute?
All right.
we can save it for the discussion.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say that I'll just say that the green graph is Taiwanese is going up greatly, okay? And those that say they're Chinese are fewer. I wanted to talk a bit about Taiwan today. And I'm just going to make a few quick points then. First of all, Taiwan is... All right, first of all, Taiwan's democratic. Democratization in Asia is relatively rare, and this is an asset for Taiwan that I think has to be emphasized in considering international relations. Secondly, I think one of the importance of understanding Taiwan history is that we're not stuck with a Chinese framework. There's a Chinese framework about which is Taiwan has two choices: unification, sometimes wrongly called reunification, and independence. And I would argue we need to forget about that, say that's a Chinese framework, it's irrelevant, and we need to talk about other things like decolonization, because the world has had a large number of decolonized societies, and I think they have some sympathy for each other. I wanted to, we can go into that more. The best international law, which is the Convention on Rights and Duties of States, which was signed in Montevideo in 1933, defines a state as, according to Article 1, having a permanent population, defined territory, government, and capacity to enter relations with other states. And Taiwan clearly has all four. Furthermore, Article 3 says the political existence of the state is independent of recognition by the states. So if you have all these four conditions and no one recognizes you, you're still a state. And so I think that's important. One more point I want to make, which criticizes Shelley Rigger, who says Taiwan's small and tiny. And I guess if many of you have been in Taiwan, you've heard this, oh, Taiwan's so tiny. It's not tiny. Taiwan is not small. Taiwan is a middle power. Its population is greater than two-thirds of the world's nations. It's about the size of Australia. Its area is greater than two-fifths of the world's nations. Taiwan has an advanced economy, a highly educated citizenry, and a large and substantial military. So Taiwan is not small and tiny, it's a middle power, and it needs to be considered in light of that. I was going to talk about the 92 consensus, but I'll leave that. And one more point that I'd like to make is that I think it's important to emphasize that nowadays, many countries, including the United States and Australia, Japan, have de facto one China, one Taiwan policies. They won't admit it, but they have it. And these countries send diplomats, to Taiwan, and they have rank and they have diplomatic privileges such as the diplomatic bag, and those countries, and Taiwan sends diplomats to these other countries, and again, they have various diplomatic privileges. And I think that's important to say. I think I'll leave it there then, and we can talk
fantastic.
More.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Bruce. And next, we'll have Garrett serve as the discussant to provide some of his reactions to the to Bruce's presentation. Oh, it's right up here. Oh, fantastic.
Okay, thanks, Russell, for putting this together. It's a great topic very close to my heart, and it's also an honor to be on the same podium with Bruce. We got to know each other in the early 1980s, when Bruce himself made history in Taiwan as the foreign Blackbeard. I think the color of your beard has changed, but I think your vitality has not changed at all since that time. We met when we visited Sid when you lived in Seattle.
Sid's right here.
Yeah, Bruce's sister right here. So what I'd like to start with is a couple remarks, and that is that, as Russell indicated to earlier already, that history of Taiwan is a very new topic. This is not really something that has been around for a long time, funny enough. My wife, who is from Taiwan, went to high school and college back in the 60s and 70s, and like many of you who are from Taiwan, they did not get history of Taiwan in school. That was not a topic that was taught. Because of the Kuomintang domination, it was always history of China and all the emperors of China that had to be memorized, but not what happened in Taiwan at all before 1949. So as Bruce indicated, history of Taiwan started in 1949. So that is, I think, an important beginning. We saw that three years ago when the Ma Ying-jeou government tried to change the history books back towards the signification direction. And at that point in time, the students in Taiwan themselves said, hey, we are not taking this. This is not our history. They wanted to discover their own history. And that is really an important point, that students, young people now in Taiwan, see themselves as Taiwanese, as Bruce has indicated, and are very eager to discover their own history. And this self-identification as Taiwanese, as self-identification with land, with the people, with the culture, that is quite important now. It is really a curiosity that we now see in Taiwan itself to find out where we came from in order to know better where we want to go. I think that is an important starting point in the whole discussion. So then to Bruce's storyline, I think that's indeed a very good storyline, and overall I would really want to agree with the emphasis on the fact that you start with the Aboriginal period and then the six colonial regimes and then going to the present where you have democratization and then Taiwanization. So if I'm going to go to a few slides to really emphasize what Bruce was talking about, so the overall theme, yes, that is great. What I'd like to see is a little bit more focus on the connection between the indigenous people and the Pacific. Bruce did mention that, but I think a picture is worth a thousand words. Here you see how from Taiwan people started to go down to the Philippines and then out to Micronesia, Polynesia, even to Hawaii and the Easter Islands. Now, this is really the start of the history of Taiwan that people don't really know very much about, and that is really so essential in the question, where are we coming from? And this is of course what the Aborigines know and feel. How did they get there? That is the story of the canoes from Orchid Island, which started to go south and then grow bigger and bigger when they were out into the Pacific. The ocean-going canoes that you know have in Polynesia look very similar to the ones from Taiwan. So that is a story of where we are coming from that is quite important. And as I said, that is something that has only been discovered over the past so many three decades. Some scholars from Australia, from the United States, basically through genetic research and linguistic research found it out. So this information is brand new, and that's important. The second point I want to emphasize, and I hope you forgive me that I'm talking a bit about the Dutch period, because I am from the Netherlands. So the Dutch period is often considered the beginning of the history of Taiwan, assuming that Bruce referred to a few minutes ago, wrote his book, and the title was The 400-Year History of Taiwan. So that was really the starting point in the view of at least a number of people. So the Dutch got there because they wanted to also participate in world trade, in the search for spices. The Spanish and the Portuguese had been there ahead of them. But they came up and they, through technology and so on, made quite a bit of headway and made it to Taiwan and established a post there. I'd like to show this picture because this picture shows over there Taiwan and the pretty extensive network that existed in the 17th century between Taiwan and the rest of the world. So this Dutch period was really the beginning of Taiwan's connection with the rest of the world. Sugar from Taiwan went all the way to Persia and Arabia, and I'm told that at one point half the sugar consumption in Persia came from Taiwan. This is just rather incredible. And Bruce already mentioned the hides, deer hides that went up to Japan. So Taiwan was really very much interlinked with the rest of the world in the 17th century. I think that is quite an important point. The Dutch literally put Taiwan on the map, and this is the first map that actually shows Taiwan. Stand up. We show it right there. They actually show it as three separate islands. But in 1596, Mr. Jan Huyven van Linschoten drew this map, the Dutch, of course, came from the west, and so he turned the map basically 90 degrees in order to show the ship captains where they turned left and where they turned right. And this map was really the major map that was used by ship captains in the beginning of the 17th century. Hundreds and hundreds of them took this map and then went off to make money, buy spices, and so on. Another point from the Dutch period that's important for the discussion that we have having now, where does the name Taiwan come from? Back in those days, the Aborigines had a name for the island, which was Pakan, and we don't quite know where it came from. Some people say it means northern harbor. The Chinese emperor referred to something like Liuzhou, but you're not quite sure if you really refer to Taiwan or to Okinawa. So as Bruce emphasized, from the Chinese perspective, little was known about Taiwan back in those days. They hardly knew of its existence. The Portuguese were the first ones to sail by it and say, hey, this is a beautiful island, Ilha Formosa. The Spanish used a slightly different name. But then the Dutch first used Formosa for the name of the island as a whole, but for the place where they landed and where they established the fortress, there was a Siraya word, the local Aboriginal group, and they had the word Taiyuan as the name for the place that either meant outsiders or sandy bank. There are different scholarly analysis on that, so I don't want to get into that discussion. But that name eventually evolved into the name Taiwan, and that became the designation for the whole island. Although the Portuguese name, Formosa, was still used for many, many centuries. And in the 1950s, when the US talked about its policy towards the place, they talked about the Formosa issue, not about the Taiwan issue. Only after the 1950s that really changed. So those are some key elements. Another key element is the growth of the Chinese population, of the Hanji population from Fujian during the Dutch period, going from just a few hundred to 1,000 or so. The person who noted, who did research on it in 1627, was this gentleman, Mr. Candidius. He was a church pastor. He went up and down the coast, and he basically did not find more than a few hundred settlers from China who were there usually on a temporary basis, some fishermen, some traders. So in all that period was Taiwan was a very lively center of trade all through Asia, and that started to change after the Manchu invasion into the Ming dynasty, where the Ming were driven out of Beijing, and that's where Mr. Chen Zhengong or Koxinga popped up. And a little bit of background on him, I'll just skip that. But the main thing is, as Bruce indicated, what Mr. Chen Zhengong tried to do in 1658-59, here was his stronghold. The whole north had been taken over by the Qing dynasty, and he, with a huge fleet, went up and up the river here to Nanjing, and almost took Nanjing. It was only through total coincidence that he didn't. So if he had taken Nanjing, he would have stayed up there, and Taiwan's history would have been totally different, because he would never have come down the coast or driven down the coast by the Qing. And he was driven down the coast, and eventually he had no way to go. So with fleet and soldiers, he went over and he invaded Taiwan, in a sense, very much as a colonial empire. So he was the one who defeated the Dutch, and he had a very brief regime, but during that period, the number of people from the coastal provinces, the Hokkien people, started to migrate more and more. So by the end of the Tsingtsungong period, there were probably about 100,000 in Taiwan, and that really brought him closer, brought Taiwan closer to China. So I'll explain in a minute. Tsingtsungong has been perceived by different people in very different ways. The Chinese see him as the one who kicked out the Dutch and the colonialists. The Kuomintang liked him because he was the one who, like Chiang Kai-shek, was kicked out of China but wanted to recover the mainland. For Taiwan independence supporters, he's actually also a model because he was the first one who established an independent nation state there. So that is something that is also quite interesting. But then last but not least, from the perspective of the indigenous people, they don't like him at all whatsoever, because and I just came back from Taiwan this weekend, and we did research in the Tainan area, and a lot of the Siraya people we talked to said, Tsingtsungong is terrible, you know, he took away our land, he took away our women, he took away everything else. He is a murderer, and that's what they literally said. So among Aborigines, he was not too much of a popular figure. And I'll come to my last slide, basically summarizing what I've said. And I think all of that is important for how we look at Taiwan now. And I think hopefully in the discussion we can go a little bit further into how democratization led to Taiwanization and what is Taiwanization. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Garrett. And thank you both for a very fascinating presentation and serving as a discussion here. And so I'd like to use the moderator's prerogative here to kick off our discussion. I know that we're above going beyond our time limit, but I think given that there's so much to unpack here, I think I'd like to go over and have a discussion here. The first is that Bruce's presentation lays out a very comprehensive overview of Taiwan's history. But over here at GTI, we want to also understand what the practical application and the policy implications are in terms of the academic research that has been painstakingly done. And so can you both help us connect the dots here and tell us how you see this long history, as Bruce skillfully presented it, impacted or affected the rise of this sort of Taiwan identity? That's the first question. I have another question too that's related to something that Bruce had said in the final slide, but maybe perhaps Bruce, you can kick it off and then, okay. You know, and then.
Well, I think this rise of Taiwan identity is important. And the point is that is part of that is that Taiwan is not China, and it hasn't been. And I think this is what policymakers have to realize, and I think it's what I would argue that there needs to be a coalition among democratic powers in Asia and in the world, which tell China, you know, this doesn't belong to you. The Chinese say it belongs to us, but it doesn't. And the history shows that it doesn't belong to China as well. And that's why I really disagree with Garrett. I think it's really important in terms of understanding history that we also emphasize that the Manchus were not Chinese. And I think that has to be stated very clearly. In terms of the rise of Taiwan identity is coming about because as Taiwan is democratized, people have an option of learning more about what their background is and their past. And they're sick of being oppressed by colonial governments, which treated them as second-class citizens. I have a lot of data on all that, which I had to cut because of time. But, you know, if you've been constantly discriminated against and finally you become a citizen, well, you want to be part of your country, not part of some other country. So I think it's really important that Taiwan pushes this point of view. And yes, of course, you don't want to upset the Chinese and you don't want to cross red lines, but I think more and more places like the United States need to emphasize. And that's where I think it sort of comes in. Now, what's also very interesting, again, I didn't get to this because I went over it, the young people more and more, and we have lots of evidence of this, including surveys in my new book, Changing Taiwanese Identity, which is coming out in a couple of months. The surveys show, and various sorts of research also show, the young people are even more overwhelmingly Taiwanese, even if their background is mainland. So in this last election, there were lots of people who are mainlander background. The people my age, the grandparents, were voting blue, either Kuomintang or one of the other parties. Their children were sometimes voting green, sometimes voting blue, sometimes abstaining. But their children, that is the young people today in their 20s and 30s, were all voting for the DPP or for the NPP in the legislature. And so there's this overwhelming sense of Taiwanese-ness that is coming about in Taiwan that, in fact, the graphs that I showed didn't actually show the full depth of this. And as I said, this comes about because Taiwan is democratized and people are aware of who they are. The other thing which I didn't emphasize, which is really important, is the number of people who either don't answer or don't know is now down to less than 4%. And it started up around 10%. What this means is people in Taiwan have thought about this question. Who are we? Who am I? Who are we? And this is questions that people have thought about, and they all have answers to it now. This is not a question which is sort of some abstract question that people have sort of, well, maybe I'll think it's this. And in Australia, too, we've had a very major change. In the 1950s in Australia, people would talk about going home. And even if they'd never left Australia their whole life, they'd been born in Australia and stayed in Australia their whole life, and they talk about going home, they meant Britain. No one talks like that anymore. It's, you know, home is Australia. So there's been a cultural shift in identity in Australia, too, in a similar period of time. So this isn't unique in the country.
Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I got 2 points, basically. One is the question, when did this Taiwanization really start, or the discovery of the Taiwanese identity? And I would venture to suggest that that was already in around 1895. Before 1895, most people considered themselves either as Hokkien or Hakka or Aborigines. There was no cohesive Taiwanese identity. But then the Japanese invaded, and in order to resist the Japanese, for the first time in Taiwan history, those three different groups had to band together to resist the Japanese. So, and that continued basically through the Japanese period. You had the various movements during the Japanese period, emphasizing the home rule movement and so on and so forth. So I think that is a point in a little bit more distant history. And then, of course, in recent history, from 88 on, it was indeed democratization that started it. And then after democratization, there was a whole explosion of people celebrating their own identity, celebrating art and culture and literature. Suddenly, Taiwanese literature became quite important and popular. So there was this very important movement in the direction of that, and as Bruce just emphasized, that encompassed basically very much of a multicultural identity. The Aborigines are part of it, the second generation mainlander kids are part of it, and so on and so forth. So there's very much of a, hey, we are in this together at the present point in time. And I think that's an important development.
Is that one thing that I've dropped that I think is relevant to Garrett's phrase, and that is, what is a Taiwanese? And let's be frank, the definition of what is a Taiwanese shifts over time. So when before the Dutch came, Taiwanese were all Aborigines. And they didn't necessarily have a Taiwan identity, but they were the Taiwanese. But as more and more people migrated to Taiwan, and they often, and by the mid-19th century, it's quite clear. It's actually a bit before the Japanese came in, where Harry Lam and showed. By the mid-19th century, there was already beginning to form quite substantial Taiwan identity. So the ethnic groupings of the different sorts of Hokkien and the Hakka and the Aborigines, which involved been involved in great battles, which they didn't have in China, they had them in Taiwan, these began to ameliorate, and this sort of new Taiwan identity from about the middle of the 19th century occurred. And I would say, to me, I think an easy definition of what the Taiwanese is anyone who lives in Taiwan and identifies with Taiwan. And I guess people who are overseas who so identify would be included. And I think that's a good definition for Taiwanese.
Related to this first question is that I've also found very interesting in the slide that you presented, Bruce, with the identification of Taiwanese and Chinese and Taiwanese and Taiwanese only or Taiwanese and Chinese, is that the pace of this growth between 2000 and 2008 was almost equal to the pace between 2008 and 2016 during the previous Ma Ying-jeou administration. So comparing the DPP administration and also the KMT administration, which, you know, as I think all of us know, Beijing accuses the DPP administration of sort of disidentification policies. So what does this mean in terms of this trajectory of this identification? If this sense of growing identity is actually happening during time, actually probably the period of time where cross-strait relations was at its most sort of stable and at its sort of, you know, quote unquote best. And also, if you were in Beijing's shoes, What would you be thinking about this trend?
Well, I think it's important to note in that, I don't know if I can bring that chart back up, but where the green line goes up and exceeds 50% for the first time is just after Ma Ying-jeou's been inaugurated. So here you have the election of the most pro-Chinese president in Taiwan since Jiang Zemin. And the number going up, saying I'm only Taiwanese, actually exceeds 50% just after he's inaugurated. And it continues to go up. I would argue that Chinese just haven't got a clue. I mean, they have their... So if you look... Anyway, if you look, you can see this going over 50% is just after Ma has been elected or inaugurated. The Chinese haven't got a clue. They when they have their cross-strait meetings with mainly Kuomintang people, you know, they just cannot cope with this identity issue, and they don't understand it, and it doesn't fit with their framework, which is, as I suggested, is just, well, I didn't say it explicitly, but I'll say it now. Their framework is just completely wrong. They don't know what's happened in Taiwan. They don't understand Taiwan's history. I gave a similar talk to this talk in Chinese and in China. And it was very interesting. I didn't change it. It's the same talk I've given in Taiwan and around the world. And I got an interesting question. They said to me, when Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan, were all the people Aborigines? And so these were people who knew what's happening in Taiwan. They knew that Ma Ying-jeou had attacked Wang Jingping. They knew all about that, but they didn't have some basic knowledge about what Taiwan was about when Chiang Kai-shek arrived. It just was total ignorance. And that sort of ignorance is very widespread in China.
Well, I was
going to
say, it's understandable that they would say that, because if I didn't know anything about Taiwan and listened to your talk, I would think, well, Taiwan was Aboriginal all right up until 1949. And you sort of missed an entire 300-year period when there was great in-migration of Chinese.
That tended to get chopped because of
this. But I mean, this is covered in your book, I think.
Yeah.
Garrett, maybe you want to comment, and then we'll open up for Q&A.
What I'd like to suggest is that looking at this graph, you know, you see in 91, only 20% of the people consider themselves Taiwanese, and then it grows. And by the time Ma Ying-jeou got into office, the Taiwanization had achieved critical mass, if I may use that word. People had started to identify themselves to such a large extent as Taiwanese. They had the desire to be themselves and be considered themselves, and also one other aspect of being Taiwanese is, hey, we want to be a full and equal member in the international community. That is also something that really didn't start until the 90s and accelerated during the Chen Shui-bian period and even during the Ma Ying-jeou period. So people basically consider themselves as a new Taiwan that wants to be considered internationally as Taiwan and not as the Republic of Confucian anymore. I think that is an important distinction there. So they want to basically be considered in their own right and in their own light, I'd like to emphasize.
Thank you, Garrett. And then with that, let's open up for Q&A and comments. Dr. Tsen.
The rise of Taiwanization, the self-identity, I think is apparent and it's coming strong. But on the other side of the street, there is another nationalism rising and kind of strong. The Chinese view, they thought Taiwan is the last symbol of the Chinese humiliation. They published hundreds and thousands of books, articles to show Taiwan indeed the last symbol of the 100 years of humiliation. Do you foresee any collision of these two forces, I say? In the future, what is going to happen if these two strong nationalism collide together?
How does one predict the immediate future? 1 year ago, I don't think anyone would have thought we would have President Trump right now. Okay? So, I mean, it's very difficult to predict. My own feeling is, and this is, I think it's a hope, but it's also, I think there's reasons for it. I think as China becomes more and more aggressive, and this nationalism is actually it's fed from the top, it's not a base, it's not fed from the base. This nationalism that the Chinese are forcing is also an expansionist, and it's leading to an aggressive expansionism in the Chinese regime. And it's pushing not only in Taiwan, it's pushing in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea. And I think this has created quite a bit of concern among the democratic powers, the US, Canada, Japan, India, Australia, the European powers. And it's my hope that these powers will eventually coalesce in a fairly strong way and act as resistance to Chinese expansion. This is sort of classical balance of power theory. Now, one of the issues comes up is trade. And as an Australian, I mean, China is our largest trading partner. But I would point out trade works two ways. And if trade is obstructed, it doesn't only hurt one side, it hurts both sides. So trade in itself is something which I think the Chinese would be careful about endangering in a significant way, although they've clearly shown a willingness to use trade for political purposes, such as what they've just done with the South Koreans, what they did with the Norwegian salmon for a while because of the Nobel Peace Prize. But I think, the fear that we will, lose out because of trade, I think is something that is not, I don't think it's a proper fear. Obviously it's better if there's peace in the world, but if the Chinese are going to continue to be aggressive, I think the precedent is what happened with Hitler. Appeasement didn't work, did it? And I think we're in a similar situation. I think there are actually a lot of parallels between the regime in China today and Hitler's regime. I'm going to go over some of them if you want, but I think the lesson is that you have, at some point you have to put down a mark, you have to draw your own red line.
I just added a point to that, Bruce, and this is something that you've observed also, which is in your slide you said that increasingly Taiwanese means that I'm not Chinese. And I wonder whether or not that is because being Chinese is now being insisted upon by Beijing as being part of the PRC, right? And so now, because you're Chinese, you need to be a part, it has to be unified under the PRC. And I think for anyone who is in Taiwan, they think, oh, well, Taiwan's not part of the PRC. Of course, and if that's the case, then certainly not Chinese.
But there's also another issue here which relates to the way Chinese look at people who have migrated. Migrants around the world, when they migrate, tend to change their identities. But the Chinese have argued that if you have Chinese blood, you stay Chinese forever. That's clearly not the case, and a good case is Gary Long, who was sent from the United States to be ambassador. And the Chinese found him really confusing because he had Chinese blood, he looked Chinese. He took his kids to Macca's. Now, no high-level official should have done that. He flew economy, shouldn't have done that. He should have at least flown business class if he was a high-level official. He carried his own bags. I mean, what kind of Chinese official does that? So it was very confusing. And then to top it off, he didn't really speak Chinese either. And he was an American. And people, when they migrate, change their identities. And no one here says, oh, we're actually British because we, you know, our ancestry came from Britain or whatever. And the same applies to Chinese. And it applies to Chinese who migrated originally from parts of China and came to Taiwan. And their identity is shifting.
This gentleman over here. And please, this way over here. Please state your name and your affiliation, and then if you have a question, address your question to a specific panelist.
Yeah, thank you. Leo Bosner. I'm one of the people just learning about Taiwan for the first time. It's fascinating. I teach disaster preparedness in Japan. I might be teaching next year in Taiwan. What can you tell me about the relations between the Taiwanese and the Japanese? Is there friction like with South Korea where they're always breaking each other's statues down, or is it more cordial or just...
I was in Korea last year, and one of my former PhD students who's Australian was teaching in Korea, and he was at the seminar. And I was trying to pursue this issue of why the relationship between Korea and Japan is very different from the relationship between Taiwan and Japan. And he said basically, if I'd said what I'd said in his seminar in a Japanese, in a Korean university, I probably would have been fired. I mean, it was a bit of a joke. But the reasons are this. Both Taiwan and Korea had tough times under the Japanese colonial regime. They were treated as second-class citizens. They were treated brutally, both regimes. Although they were run a bit differently, the Taiwan regime seems to have been run by the Japanese Navy and the Korean regime by the Japanese Army. They both were treated poorly. Now, the Koreans had a national image, which the Taiwanese did. They had a king and a queen, etc. But the anti-Japanese-ness which was in Korea continued, and in Taiwan what happened was, even though things had been tough and cruel, when the nationalists came in, they were tough and cruel, but they were also inefficient. So there's a famous slogan, you know, the dogs were bad, but the pigs are worse. You know, because they weren't running anything efficiently and were using up all the money. So I think there's a looking back that the Japanese weren't as bad as they were. But they weren't very good. But because the nationalists came in and were even worse, they sort of, just looking backwards towards Japanese history, it looks better than it really was. And that has been part of the reason that Taiwanese have a much smoother relationship with Japan. And in fact, it's very smooth. Japan is seen as one of the best countries, and there's quite a bit of interaction. Under Chiang Kai-shek, Japanese wasn't taught, but it is now, and it's quite a widespread language.
One additional point of information is, in spite of the Japanese colonial period in Taiwan, most people in Taiwan, particularly the older people, look at the Japanese period very positively. But also the young people, I just came back from Taiwan, as I mentioned, and I did research what young people in Taiwan, high school, college kids, feel about the Dutch period, Zhenzengong period, the Qing dynasty, and the Japanese period. I won't bother to mention the others at this point, but the Japanese period came out very positively. About 70-75% of these young kids thought it had been good for Taiwan, and only 10-15% thought it had been kind of not so good for Taiwan. So that's, I think, interesting piece of information.
I think there was a question in the back. Julian?
Yeah, thank you very much. That was a terrific presentation from both of you. Julian Baum, I'm a journalist who was based in Taiwan for a long time. I'd like to ask both of you about the normalization of this concept that the KMT is a colonial regime. I remember in the late 90s, Lee Teng-hui gave an interview, and he said that the KMT arriving in Taiwan was like an invading imperial army, and it created enormous uproar. Of course, Beijing saw that as anathema and accused him of being a traitor and a Japanese, but among the Taiwan scholarly community, of course, it was also not acceptable. I think to most scholars of Asia and China affairs, it would seem rather very left-wing to talk about the KMT as an invading army and a colonial occupying regime. Do you see that this concept is becoming more acceptable, and have you had much pushback on that?
Okay. Let me just say, one of the first to make this point was Paris Zhang, who made it in the, it related to the, I can't remember now, but it was fairly early on. I think in English, I've probably been pushing this a bit harder than most people, because I think it's right. And I think when we look at the Kuomintang regime as a colonial regime, as I suggested, a lot of comparisons with the Japanese, and the way it operated, it makes sense. And you have this context of a Taiwan which is aboriginal. The Dutch come in, bring in Chinese for the first time on a permanent basis, and it's continuous, all these foreign regimes coming in, operating in the interest of themselves rather than the Taiwanese, and the Chinese nationalists are another one that does that. I mean, you know, again, this is something that got chopped, but no Taiwanese, of course, was president under Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Ching-kuo, but no Taiwanese were premier, there were several ministries no Taiwanese ever held. Education, economics, finance, of course, foreign affairs, national defense. No Taiwanese was ever a member, was ever head of the government information office. So all these positions were sort of reserved for the minority of mainlanders, so it's less than 15%. And Joseph Wu's in his book has a wonderful statistic. Under Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Ching-kuo, the cabinet and the central standing committee of the Kuomintang were always, a majority were always mainlanders under Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Ching-kuo. Taiwanese, to the extent they were in, were always a minority. And it's only after Li Dianhui comes to power that this changes. So there's a definite Taiwanese are treated as second-class citizens. So I think it fits perfectly. The one question that people raise is, well, the Chinese lost their motherland, in a sense, but they didn't lose their identity. They lost the physical motherland that they governed from. But I think it's still colonial.
I would just add that both Paris Zhang and Joseph Wu are very senior DPP officials from the first DPP administration and now currently in the second administration.
Can I just have a follow-up on Wu's mentioned? You said there's no president as Taiwanese, but when Zhang Jinbo picked up Li Dianhui, a local Taiwanese, as a successor, what you think that means?
Okay, let me just, I've interviewed extensively on this. Zhang Jinbo did not pick Li Denghui as his successor. Okay, I want to say, Zhang Jinbo did not pick Li Denghui as his successor. He expected to last the 6 years of his career. And he had picked Chen Dongming as his vice presidential nominee, and as Li Denghui, as an attempt to give Taiwanese a bit more space. And this was something that Zhang Jinbo did that Chiang Kai-shek never did. But it was never choosing him as his successor. And Jay Taylor's book has a really interesting, I think it's in a footnote. When Zhang Jinbo was ill and in the hospital, no Taiwanese could visit. They shouldn't get into the room. And it's very, I've interviewed Li Denghui many times, and I've read his book, Witness to Taiwan, Jinzhen Taiwan. It's a fabulous book. It has a lot of really interesting things. And there was one time when we went in a group interview, a lot of foreigners, and this was after he was no longer president. And I was given the opportunity, he gave the book out to everybody else that had, but I was given the opportunity to ask question after question after question. And it was just wonderful because it was very clear that under Zhang Jinbo, there was prejudice, and it was very clear that he was not the successor. In fact, he didn't even know he was going to be chosen. He told me the story. People came up to him at the Kuomintang meeting that was going to nominate him as vice president and kept congratulating him. He didn't know what he was being congratulated for. And then it was announced that he was to be the vice president's presidential candidate. And he was a bit of a, he had been educated by Zhang Jinbo in local politics. And he was a bit unsure of how to campaign to become president because you had to get votes from the National Assembly. So his wife had prepared all his books and reprinted all his publications in English and in Chinese, including his PhD thesis. And there are three volumes that I have to have. It's about 5 kilograms and maybe 10, 15 pounds, these three volumes. And he gave each of the members of the National Assembly his collected works on rural economic development. It's interesting, but it's wrong to say he was chosen as the successor because he wasn't. And he had to fight very hard and work very hard to not only become president, but to become chairman of the party and to gain real power. There was a massive political battle that took place in Taiwan following Jiang Zemin's death. I've written a bit about this in the book Taiwan, Democratizing Taiwan, if you're interested.
Garrett, with a comment, and then one last question.
One more point on the Kuomintang as a colonial regime. I think it's important also to note that until the mid-90s, all the history books in Taiwan glorified that period. You know, this was the great and glorious arrival of Chiang Kai-shek and so on and so forth. But since that time, I think the history books are showing much more of a realistic picture. The 228 is being discussed pretty extensively. The Kaohsiung incident is discussed pretty extensively. So gradually, the people are really looking at it more for what it was worth and not this glorious high period.
I lied. Two last questions. I'm going to group to two last questions. This gentleman in front and our co-founder in the back.
First of all, I'm so happy, you know, because Bruce, I met him back in 1972. I came to United States in 1973. At that time, Bruce, he riding a bicycle, right? You riding because he's the Bo Si Lung Wen, the seer for her postdoctor is the Taiwan Di Fang Zi Zi. And every day, every night, and he went to Li Min Da Hui, Li Min Da Hui. And besides, he able to speak Taiwan way, Gong Lang Na Lao To Bui Bo To Dao. Okay? And the shortcut, because it just happened, from 1964 to 1973, I worked for the U.S. Naval Medical Research Unit. And we have a maternal nutrition project in the Shui across the river to the Puzi, okay? And then my boss one day said, Mr. Wen, would you help me to go to the Puzi to meet Dr. Jeffcott? 那时候还不是 doctor, okay? So I went to see him three times, okay? In 73, when I came to the United States, I know he is the one of the mystery person during that Lin Yixiong 事件, the mother and the two twin girls are murdered. At that time, nobody dared to approach his house, but he always fight for the human right, okay? But since then, I lost the information of the him.
Thank you, sir. Do you have a question, actually?
And this is the side issue, okay, and the side issue. Because the question, the identity, just use my own personal experience, okay? I was born in 1939. At that time, I am the citizen of the Japan, okay? And later, in 1945, Chiang Kai-shek came over to Taiwan. Now I became a citizen of the Republic of China. In 73, I came here. Later on, I became a citizen. Now I am the citizen of the USA. Okay? Just like the example, Chen Tang San, Dan Wei Chen, Dan Wei Kira Dan. In Akong, he is Dan. The Bun Lang Lai, Dan, normal Dan, is a Jin San. Jin San. When Chen Tang San cannot go back to Taiwan to visit his parents due to the blood disease, right? So his father came to the Washington D.C. When get in the USA.
Thank you for sharing the story. But perhaps you can take this offline and maybe after the meeting.
You say one family name being called for different kind of the situation. Okay? That is very sad. That's why we are emphasized for Taiwan identity. So I think I'm going to the main course, okay?
Thank you.
And thank you for you giving the time, okay?
Thank you. And then one last question, sir. Can you do that?
First, I'd like to salute to the two speakers. And Bruce, I have known you in Taiwan in 1980 because your picture, beard, was shown on TV. That's because the Lin Yisheng incident. You know, his mother was murdered by Kuomintang. And the Kuomintang government accused Bruce is the mastermind behind it. So how ridiculous. And then second, I'm honored to know Gary and me since 1971 at the University of Washington, Seattle. I know he has worked for the Taiwan Corps since then. So that's 46 years. So that kind of persistence is very heroic. Right? So far around, I have two questions. And as we can see, everything Taiwan is related to the international community. How are the politics also local? And my two questions is that recently there are two events, and I don't like to see your reflection or your thought on that. The first one is recently, just a couple of days ago, the Japanese civil engineer, Barton, that's in Chinese. He was the one beer at that time during before the war. He beer after the dam in Taiwan to irrigate. So he is really respected by most of people in Taiwan. However, due to the different ideology, his statue in Wusanto, the Wusan Dam, was beheaded.
Has it been determined what
of course, this kind of extreme behavior is by a very small group of people. You know, and however, it seemed to me the Taiwanese are too minor. You know, and I like to know your reflection on that. Okay. The second one is recently a human rights activist in Taiwan name is called Li Mingzhe. He was arrested by Chinese government because he was on his mission to there. And he had some kind of medical problem and his wife wanted to bring the medicine to him. But he was denied the entry to China. And his wife said, you know, I'm not going, and the Chinese trying to negotiate through some private channel. And his wife said, I don't want to accept this kind of compromising. So I think to me, the wife is quite brave. And so I also like to see your feedback on the Chinese behavior.
Well, on the Hata case, the man's, the Yoichiro Hata was the man who founded the Jan'an Irrigation. So the main irrigation in southern Taiwan was founded by Hata. And there was a statue built by the Japanese for him after he died that put at the irrigation center. When the Chinese nationalists came in, the statue was hidden because they were afraid the nationalists would boil it down for the bronze. But it was come back out. And it was recently beheaded, and they now know who did it because there was CCTV TV coverage, and one of the two people involved was from the China Unification Promotion. I think most people would agree that's not the right thing to do. They might have been in response to the disfigurement of Chiang Kai-shek statues, but there was an interesting editorial in the Taipei Times recently which said Chiang Kai-shek is not parallel to Hata, and showed there a lot of differences. The Hata was doing things useful to people in Taiwan, and Chiang Kai-shek was killing people in Taiwan. But their statue would be repaired and put back up. There was another statue which some people were complaining about, but apparently that statue has been fixed and is waiting to be put in a park where it's visible. Now the Li Mingzhe case, I'm going to go to Garrett on this because Garrett has led an international movement to sign a letter which has just been publicly purchased, a letter to President Xi Jinping. I was happy to co-sign it as well, but Garrett was one of the drafters, so I'll leave it to him.
Very glad to see while I'm here, some people ask me what generated your interest in Taiwan, and I always say my wife Mei Jin. But actually, before I met Mei Jin in 1973, I met Huang Hua, and Huang Hua was really the first person who generated my interest in Taiwan. And then I started to read Formosa, the Trade, and so on. So that's very nice to see him here. As Bruce basically indicated already, the case of the Japanese civil engineer, you must relegate that to a group of right-wing pro-unification extremists that is not representative of view of people in Taiwan at all whatsoever. The Li Mingzhe case, as Bruce also just emphasized, we did a joint letter by a number of scholars internationally, 44 people, and Bruce and I signed it, and I see several of the other co-signers here. Joe Bosco was prominently mentioned in the Liberty Times today, and Wen Yan was also part of it. I think it's important to emphasize that because his case is something that does represent Taiwan. This is the new Taiwan where people are interested in human rights, where people are interested in democracy. And if people like that cannot travel to China, that is really something very damaging for the relations between Taiwan and China. And as we emphasize in the letter, it really is damaging the relations to such an extent that people in Taiwan do not really trust the Chinese side anymore. Not that we really trusted them in the first place, but it is something that really deteriorates the situation even further. So I think that is an important signal to send to China that this is something that is not really beneficial to cross-strait relations. And they themselves have always emphasized we want to have good cross-strait relations and so on and so forth. But that is not a move in the right direction. And I think coming from a group of international scholars, that is quite important. And we hope it does help in Beijing that they understand Taiwan better. And with that, I'd like to close.
Thank you. And with that, that's the last word for today's event, and please join me in thanking our presenters. And just one last note is that our next event will be on Monday, next Monday, with Mike Green. He has recently published a book called By More Than Providence, where he addresses the history of American grand strategy in the Asia Pacific. And so he has graciously offered to come by and talk to us about his book and how it fit, and how one fits. So, you know, if you haven't already registered, please do so. All right, thank you.